Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from the mushing capital of the world in Willow, Alaska, with 7 inches of fresh snow. It's melting fast, but at least it's winter here in Alaska. And today is our day 16 coverage of the 2016 Iditarod here on Mushing Radio. This is our closing show for our coverage of the year. It's been a blast. We've covered a lot of topics. We've talked about a lot of mushers, a lot of news. And I can proudly say that we're one of the very few people that stuck it out all the way to the end on our daily coverage. And I have to commend both Alex and myself for that. I don't know if you're supposed to commend yourself, but at least we did anyway. We pulled it through, and somehow or another, we got 16 shows on the air. And I think we did a pretty good job based on the comments and likes on Facebook and people giving us high fives on the internet. So thanks a lot for all the fans that listened. We tried our best to get all of our questions, all of your questions answered as we went along. So calling in from Southern California, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. And I feel like the exhausted guy in the band who comes back out on stage and just says one more time, even though he's almost about to drop over. But it's been a very interesting and at times very emotional Iditarod this year. And as you said, a lot of people really kind of packed it in terms of coverage and in terms of what they were doing and what they were talking about shortly after the first 10 or 20 teams came in. And I do think that there is something to be said for sticking it out until the end. It certainly is. It's no less an accomplishment for Mary Helwig to finish the race as the Red Lantern than it is for Dallas and Mitch Seavey to finish 1 and 2. It's a different accomplishment, and there are different skills that go into it. And I do not imagine that Mary Helwig started the race thinking that she was going to win. But just anyone who can enter and complete the qualifiers and get everything ready and complete this race is deserving of an enormous amount of praise. And I think that's what we've been focused on for all of our coverage is trying to look at some of the stories and some of the people that just don't get a lot of attention.
Right. And as we've mentioned several times over our coverage today, Mary was one of those folks, as well as Dee Dee and Jan Steves and so many other mushers here in Willow that lost their home to the Willow, to the Sockeye fire that was just north of us in Willow in mid-June of last year. And, you know, that lady there, like all of them, has a ton of perseverance, and she pulled it through. We mentioned that she was living in a rented RV for a long time in the depths of winter here in Willow is minus 25 degrees, and she didn't know if she's going to much less have a house that she could stay in over Christmas. Now here she has ran the Iditarod and finished as the Red Lantern winner, so we definitely got to take our hats off to her, as well as all of the other mushers that pulled through all of their issues this year and not only made it a great race for the field, but also for all of us fans and people that are reporting on it and writing about it and talking about it for 2 weeks in March every year.
Yeah, and just briefly for those who don't know, Mary Helwig came in a little bit before midnight last night. People who have been watching the teams come in might know that the first team, there are always – when the winter comes in, there's always a ton of people. There's usually more than 1,000 people on Front Street to welcome in the winner. As it goes farther and farther, there are often not nearly as many people, and when the back of the packers start coming in, sometimes there's only a few dozen or 100 people out to welcome them. There always are people who come out and welcome them. The fire siren goes off when there's about 10 to 15 minutes before they come in, so people can gather at the Broad Arch. But then, invariably, when the Red Lantern comes in, that is a much bigger deal than the three or four people who come in before the Red Lantern. So when Mary came in, it looked like there were several hundred people out on Front Street, even though it was almost midnight. She said that she had broken her sled on the farewell burn and sort of patched it together, and it totally broke on the way to Nikolai, and she was able to borrow a sled from Scott Jansen, the mushing mortician who had scratched. So she actually came in, finished with Scott's sled. And we've seen a couple of people who have had sled problems, who've had to borrow sleds from other teams. I think we've talked about this a couple of times, that people can ship sleds up to checkpoints along with their food bags and other things. So you can have a sled that you would switch out, you know, halfway into the race, or sometimes people ship sleds to Unalakleet because they want a different sled, I think a lighter sled when they're coming up the coast than they might want at the beginning of the race. So she was able to finish with Scott's sled, and she said that she had a skittish dog at one point who got loose, but Larry Daugherty, who also is a rookie, who we talked about a few nights ago, caught the dog and returned the dog to her, so she was able to continue, and seemed to be in amazing spirits when she finished, and just very happy with the way her dogs performed, very happy with the way her race had gone.
Good stuff there. You know, I do, again, have to commend every one of those guys, and it has to be a special thing to finally make it there. You know, you're running in last place. You know, the odds are against you, so to speak, being there's nobody behind you. You know, the checkers are ready to go home. The race is ready to roll up. And there you go on Front Street. And you know what I noticed? I haven't really paid much attention to this before, but all of the video coverage I've seen this year, they have the police cars that give them the escort there on Front Street. Is that a normal thing, or is that something new they did this year?
Yeah, that's a normal thing. The police cars sort of, I think, keep the pedestrians on the side of the road. Some people will come out and try to high-five the mushers, but it can be very distracting for the dogs when they suddenly are on a steep street that's, you know, it's not like a major boulevard, but it's a much wider expanse than what they're used to on a relatively narrow trail. And sometimes the dogs will be distracted by people, and you want to just get the dogs going up into the chute and under the arch. You don't want to have to have the dogs, you know, get tangled or get confused or have any sort of run-ins with the people before they get to the arch. So they usually, I think, have the police that will start at the ramp on the edge of town where they come up from the ice, and the police will give them an escort for the first few blocks and then kind of drop back, so that when they run the last six or seven blocks before they get to the chute, it's just the dogs and the team.
Very cool stuff. So the banquet is getting underway right now. I saw a bunch of pictures and videos from all of my friends' feeds on Facebook, and they look like they're enjoying the festivities. I know that, you know, throughout the evening, they will give out all of the awards, you know, the most coveted awards in Iditarod, the Sportsman's Award and the Vets Award, and, you know, all of those very important awards out there that to some are just as important to get as a winning finish. You know, as a musher, you always want to go after, to be honored, I guess, not go after. You want to be honored for that veterinary care award. That speaks volumes to you and your team, just how well you take good care of your dogs out on the trail. I think that, to me, that's just as important as doing very well in the race as well. Also, during the banquet, we've talked about this many times, at the ceremonial musher draw banquet on Thursday before the start in Anchorage, you don't get to say a whole lot there at the podium. You're pretty much drawing your number, thanking some sponsors or your family and friends. But at the finishers banquet, realistically, you could talk as long as you want. And I know that people share a lot of stories from the trails and, you know, of course, thank all of their sponsors and their families and, you know, all of those high fives that they do. But you can stand up there as long as you like. Isn't that right, Alex?
Yeah. And it used to be the case that mushers could, in the very first years, mushers could talk a lot longer in the banquet in Anchorage. But what they found was that some of the mushers would just go on forever. And then that banquet wouldn't actually end until, you know, the early hours of the morning. And nobody wanted that because they wanted to be able to get some sleep in a real bed the last couple nights before the race started. So at some point, and I believe it may have been as early as the early 80s or mid 80s, they started having severe limits to how much mushers could say on that in that opening banquet. And as a result, pretty much mushers will they'll announce their draw number, their starting number, and they'll thank a few sponsors, maybe a family member or two, and that's pretty much it. They try to get them on and off the stage very, very quickly. At the finishers banquet, they first go and present they first present the prizes, the special prizes, the first to McGrath prize, the first to the Yukon, the first to the halfway point. And then they go literally from the Red Lantern winner all the way up to the first prize winner. So there would be, each of those people will be introduced and will be able to talk pretty much for as long as they want. And some people will be very quick, will be on and off in, 30 seconds or a minute. And other people will tell stories. They'll talk about things that happened on the trail, things that were particularly interesting or unusual this year. But almost always the mushers will thank all of the volunteers. And we've talked about this a lot in the past. I'm not sure that much this year, but really it's the volunteers who make this race possible. And there's every year, I believe, somewhere between 2,000 to 2,500 volunteers who come in not only from different parts of Alaska, but from all over the United States and all over the world to volunteer and work for the race, either, some people in Anchorage and answering phones, people working as dog handlers, people taking care of drop dogs, and people going all the way up the trail. And that goes for the people at checkpoints, and it goes for the veterinarians who are all volunteers, and almost all of the race officials are volunteers as well.
You know, Alex, I'm sitting here looking at some of the pictures on the Iditarod Trail Committee Facebook page, and one of them that stands out is a fruit basket, I guess it is. It looks like a dog sled that is absolutely overflowing with chocolate-covered strawberries, and it looks like they've made a rose carnation-type thing out of watermelon. Very nicely done. It looks like a catered affair. You know, the banquet in Anchorage, I've had a chance to be at that a couple of times, and that, is definitely kind of a catered-type dinner. You have your option of steak or fish or chicken or whatever they're having. But this one looks a little bit more low-key than that. It's not necessarily the you know, the white tablecloth type as it is at the Millennium, or not the Millennium, the Denina Center. Is this also a catered affair, and is the public allowed in? And do you have any idea how much the tickets cost to get in to this banquet?
It is. First of all, it takes place at the Gnome Rec Center, which is pretty much, it looks like a what you would think of as a school gymnasium might have looked like in the 70s or 80s. So there are bleachers. They clear away an area in the center, and there are tables set up. It's all long tables, so it's not like at the opening banquet where there are small tables of you know, 10 or 15 people at each table. This is very, very long tables where there's maybe 60 or 70 people just sitting right next to each other, very close quarters. It is open to the public, and almost everyone who comes up to Gnome for the finish of Iditarod ends up going to the banquet and buying tickets to the banquet. When I was there in 2010, I believe the tickets were somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 or $45. I'm sure they're more now, but given how expensive everything is in Gnome, that's actually not that bad. In Gnome, during the winter, it's very hard to get fresh fruit. It's very, you know, the fruit that there is available in the supermarkets is incredibly expensive. So this is catered by the chefs at the lakefront, formerly the Millennium Hotel in Anchorage. And they fly all of the stuff up, and they have prime rib, and I believe they have chicken, and they have some vegetarian dish, which I'm sure is for the people who are not from Alaska. I don't know that there are that many vegetarians in Alaska. And they have salads, and they have all of that fruit that you mentioned. And then they have an entire table of desserts, so little pieces of cake and tarts and things like that. And it's all served buffet style. So first of all, you know, it is a little bit expensive, but given how expensive everything else is in Gnome, it's actually a pretty good value. And you get to hang out with all of the mushers and all of the race officials and the volunteers. And it's a real social event for the end of Iditarod. It is not broadcast. Well, I should rephrase that. It's not broadcast so that you can get it outside of Gnome. Every year they have this discussion about whether they should broadcast it and make it available on the Iditarod Insider. And I believe there is a radio station in Gnome that broadcasts it live to Gnome, but that radio station does not stream, so you can't get the broadcast unless you're actually in Gnome.
Interesting stuff for sure. So, Alex, what news items do we have for today before we get into we have one topic that we want to mention, something that we've been wanting to talk about, but we just haven't, and then our final musher profile of the year. So what news do you have?
Just a couple of quick things. When we were talking about what goes on and what people can do in Gnome after they finish, after mushers finish, one thing I forgot to mention was at the Breakers Bar, which is one of the bars in Gnome, there is every year an arm wrestling contest, which is very famous locally in Gnome. And every year there's a few mushers who will enter this contest. And, you know, it's a little bit different from Iditarod because the winner only gets $75 and there's no truck involved. But people might remember this contest because last year, Ali Zirkel was one of the mushers involved, and she actually broke a woman's arm. who had to then go to the hospital because she had her arm broken by Allie Zirkle in the arm wrestling contest.
I wonder if she got her to sign her cast.
I would imagine she would. And it just it is one of those things that really goes to show that you should not mess with Alaskan women. They are much tougher than one might imagine. And they have lightweight, middleweight, and heavyweight divisions for both men and women. They have six different divisions. They don't all compete together. And I believe the winner in each division gets $75, and the second and third place get a plaque or a trophy or some little thing like that.
Right.
And then perhaps more important than that, there is a mandatory mushers meeting. There's a mandatory meeting for finishers of Iditarod. I'm not positive exactly when that happens. I believe it might be Sunday morning. It might have been this morning. And that is closed off to the press and the public. It is just the Iditarod Trail Committee, the race marshal, and the mushers. So it's a place where people can go behind closed doors and raise concerns and questions and bring up issues that they feel are very important to this year's race and to the race going forward. And a lot of years, people will discuss in sort of general terms things that had been brought up. This year with the gag rule, I expect there's probably going to be a lot less of that, but it would not surprise me at all to hear that they were talking about the snow machine incident and the need for security and the need to have better outreach to some of the local communities. But
right.
I don't know that. That's just my speculation.
Right. And I know you had a topic you wanted to discuss. That, like I said, we wanted to bring this up before, but we never had. So what's your question? And I'll be, as best as I can, I'll try to answer it, then you can give your theories.
So we've seen a lot of people who – we've seen and talked about a lot of people who have different backgrounds and bring different skills and areas of expertise and attitudes towards dog mushing. So my question for you, and I have a theory about this as well, is what qualities do you need to be a good dog musher?
Well, first and foremost, you have to have a good job or quite a bit of money. I think that's the probably the number one quality that you have to have. Secondly, we tend to be a little bit more risk-taking, I guess. We're a little bit outside-the-box thinkers. Probably any musher would tell you that we don't necessarily subscribe to all of society's norms. Also, in terms of physique, there are very few Iditarod mushers that have the build as I. And I'm a bigger guy. I'm about 5'10", about 205 pounds. Some of the bigger guys out there have been in the past. Mike Williams is a pretty big guy. Scott Jansen is also a pretty big guy, as well as Jake Berkowitz. He's a pretty big guy like me, and I'm not trying to point fingers at anybody because I'm a big guy myself, but you'll often find smaller guys like Dallas Seavey, a very fit, very skinny, very muscular type guy, and of course that comes into play on how well that you can control your sled. If a person weighs 150 versus a guy that weighs 200, that just means that those dogs have to pull 50 pounds less for 1,000 miles. In terms of physique, you want really strong core muscles, the core there in your abs and in your back. You also have to have great cardio to be able to run up and down quite a few hills, and you have to have quite a bit of arm strength, of course, to pull the sled around and to move dogs around back and forth. For folks that don't know, this is really a 24-hour job, 365. Another quality that you just have to have, and I know we've mentioned it a couple of times here on this show, if you are married, you have to have a very willing and supportive wife. If you do not, it's not going to work out very well, unfortunately. Also, we talked about money, we talked about physique, we talked about the wife. And of course, you have to have an ability to read and train your dogs. And, you know, we've talked a lot about this in past coverages about how the guys and gals that lease the teams, they don't seem to do as well as the guys that spend day in and day out, 365 days a year, raising those teams from puppyhood. If you don't have that bond, it's just not the same. And, you know, there's no easy way to point that out. But, it's something that has to occur. A great example of that is we always have people that want to learn how to be mushers out at our kennel. And they'll come over and learn, you know, kind of the ropes, they will. And they always say, Robert, how come these dogs respond so well to you? How come they stand still when you're putting on booties or the harnesses? And when I come up, you know, they're jumping around and screaming and hollering, and I just can't get it done. And I will tell them, they do not respect you. They have not built up that bond with you. So that is so important that you have that ability to do that. But again, I think first and foremost, you have to have a very nice pocketbook in order to do this, especially in Iditarod. Because if you don't, I'm not saying that there are people out there that have leaner pocketbooks than others, but you can see just by the teams on the trail and, you know, the equipment and all that sort of stuff, that they have a little bit easier time, so to speak, if they can afford things. You know, it's just like in life. If a person is struggling out there, life is a little rougher versus a person that has a little bit more means to support themselves. So those are what I can think of just right off the top. Alex just kind of pointed this question to me about 2 minutes before airtime, so I didn't have any good time to prepare, but that's sort of my thought. So what are your theories, Alex?
You know, I think, first, I agree with everything you said, and I think you have to be able to communicate with dogs. And I think you can learn some of that, but I don't know how much of it you can learn. I think some of it is just really innate, that some people have an ability to be able to communicate with dogs really well, and other people just don't. So I think that's a large part of it. I think looking at a lot of the people we've talked about this year and in the past couple of years, you need to have an ability to both be able to plan things in advance and be able to improvise when things suddenly happen that you haven't planned for. And
right.
I don't know which of those is more important, but I know that you need to be able to do both of them. Because we've seen people who have come into the race with incredibly detailed plans, and then something has happened that makes the plan not really viable, and those who insist on sticking to their plan and insist on doing what they had decided before they got into the thick of things sometimes can get themselves into trouble. We've also seen some teams that don't seem to have any real sense of what's going to happen and just are instinctive and react to everything as it comes up. And there's a very few people who can do that without having a good plan and succeed. But for the most part, people who rely too much on doing things by the seat of their pants tend to also get themselves into trouble. They tend to be very high-risk, high-reward types of mushers. And when things go well for them, they're amazing. And when things do not go well, it can just be awful. So I think that balancing those two things, the ability to learn and pre-plan and anticipate, and the ability to be able to think on your feet and throw things out and just do what needs to be done. It's a difficult balancing act between the two of them.
Oh, I agree. And you spoke about being able to communicate with dogs. And, you know, in the off season or when I'm not mushing dogs, I train pet dogs for a living. I'm a dog trainer and I have been since the early 90s. And people always say, where did you get your experience in training dogs? You're just so good at it. And I will tell them I've literally lived with a pack of sled dogs for the last 20 years. It's just something that I have learned, and I have plenty of experience, you know, book knowledge from dog training. I've gone to dog trainer schools, et cetera, et cetera. But in order to become a successful dog trainer and or musher, you have to learn how to read the dogs and communicate with them. So I agree with that. And just one point on that planning part, we talked about it quite a bit this season, Alex, with Mitch Seavey. And we talked about his plan that he set way back in July. And his first and foremost goal was to beat his son, Dallas. And unfortunately, he did not do that yet again this year. But he also planned to run a record-breaking race. And I believe he said he was going to do it in 8 days and 18 hours or something like that. And he ended up doing it in 8 days and 13 hours, I believe. So he had a very strict plan that he set way back in July. How many months ago is that? 8 months ago. And he stuck to that plan, and he did very well with that. And again, I think you do have to be able to not only plan meticulously and have all the logistics lined out, but you have to be able to roll with the punches, so to speak, because so many things happen, not only out there on the Iditarod, but you know, just your basic training runs out in the backyard, or, you know, your dog truck breaking down, going to a qualifying race, or your sled disintegrating in front of you on the trail, as we mentioned with Mary Helwig just a few minutes ago, and she had to borrow a sled from Scott Jansen. So you have to be able to be very cognizant of all those things that happened. Anything else on that topic, or shall we move on?
Let us move on.
All right.
I'm just, before we get into the musher of the day, I just wanted to mention that very briefly that the village of Nulato gave a special award to Ali Zirkel and Jeff King, and they both gave a speech about that. Both of the speeches apparently were very emotional, and there were special gifts from the village of Nulato. Jeff King said that he felt that it was very much a case of being at the wrong place at the wrong time. There also, he spoke to Shannon Moore, who is a columnist for the Alaska Dispatch News, and a friend of Jeff's. And he said that a lot of people have been calling for very, very drastic punishment for the snow machiner in question. And Jeff said that that he's aware that there are a lot of these places in Alaska where there is access to alcohol, not a lot of economic opportunity, and people have a little bit too much free time. And he said that he thought it would be more helpful to give this guy a job rather than give him a long prison sentence. So, you know, obviously we are not going to solve all of the sociological problems of the world, but just wanted to mention that. I know it's that incident has been on a lot of people's minds for the past week or so.
So let me kind of put you on the spot there with that, Alex, if I can. Do you think that it was necessary for the folks of Nulato to give them an award? And if you do or if you don't, what do you think the reasoning was behind it? You know, obviously they want to say, hey, this isn't our community as a whole. We're much better than that. But why do you think that they needed to recognize them or give them an award, so to speak? I know there's that's kind of a touchy question, but I think it's an interesting to one to kind of figure out on why they felt that they needed to take that extra step.
You know, I don't. I can't speak for them, but if it were me, I would say that I don't think they needed to give them that award, but I think that there was such an overwhelming feeling of the people in the village that they wanted to make sure that that the Iditarod in general and Jeff and Allie in particular understood that this was not how the entire village viewed them or viewed the Iditarod, and that they just wanted to make sure that everyone knows that that this was a horrible incident that the people who run the village and the elders and the villagers are all very sorry to have seen happen.
It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out, not only in the court system, but how, if anything, the Iditarod addresses this, how, you know, we talked about it in depth on that Saturday over a week ago now when it did happen, about some of the issues in the villages and if and or when Iditarod will address some of those. So it'll be interesting to see how the sort of off season goes for this. And for anybody that follows the NFL or any other professional sport, things like this happen, not necessarily to this magnitude, but often they'll have, you know, issues that happen over the season, and then they take that off season to try to reevaluate things and implement new policies and, you know, change things and work with communities and all that. So I hope, at least personally, that, you know, the Iditarod really sits down and tries to figure out solutions to this. Of course, they don't hold all the keys to the kingdom, so to speak, but I think that they have enough, I don't want to say power or influence, but at least enough clout, I guess is a better word, in the villages where if they wanted to make some positive changes, they would be able to do so. What is your thought on that? Then we'll jump into our Musher profile.
I am hopeful that they'll be able to find a way to turn this around and turn it into a positive opportunity to make some real changes out there in these villages. You know, this is a very difficult situation, and there are a lot of factors that go into this, more factors than, frankly, can be addressed just by the Iditarod. But I think that starting to have these kind of conversations is a really great first step. It's only the first step, and there's a lot of other things that can and I think should happen. But I think that this is really necessary, especially in light of what happened. And, you know, again, I'm not living in Alaska, and I'm certainly not living out in these villages, so I'm not there on the ground, and I don't pretend to know what the answer is. But I'm hopeful that people who are on the ground and people who do know a lot better than I do will be able to make a real difference.
So we'll keep you guys up to date for sure on our biweekly show that will start here in a couple of weeks coming up here on the same channel on mushingradio.com. So, Alex, let's talk about our last musher of the season. We've carried 15 of them so far. We've had a lot of interesting stories. We've had a lot of side stories aside from the nightly profile. We talked about Trent Herbst and Alan Eichens just the other day. We've talked about Lance Mackey and Jason Mackey and Karin Hendrickson and a whole bunch of other folks in our nightly coverage. But we knew going into this it was going to be a very difficult decision to pick 15 or 16 folks to really profile each night. And I know you had mentioned to me a couple of weeks ago that you really wanted to concentrate on the women mushing in the Iditarod this year, and we've done that. Pretty much, we've had a couple of nights where we've talked about some guys, but tonight we're going to talk about Kim Franklin. And I know we talked about Miss Franklin the day that she had lost her team and she had, you know, been separated for quite a while. I think it was 12 or 14 hours or so that she was without her dog team, and we sort of mentioned that, and you know where she is running her dogs from. We'd mentioned Dean Osmar and you know that whole situation. But let's dive into this a little deeper, Alex. What do you want to know? What do folks want to know about Kim Franklin, and what can you share?
Okay, so first of all, this was a very, very large Iditarod this year. We had 85 teams who started, 71 who finished, 13 scratches, and one withdrawal. The largest Iditarod ever was 2008, and there were 96 teams that started, 78 finished, 17 scratches, and one team who was withdrawn. And the team that was withdrawn in 2008 was Kim Franklin. So here's what happened. First of all, Kim Franklin is from the UK. If you've seen pictures of this year's Iditarod, she is almost always wearing a very bright orange, pink, and blue parka. For the ceremonial start, she was wearing a big Western cowboy hat. She started by getting Malamutes. She got a couple of Malamutes in the 80s and 90s, got very interested in mushing in the 90s, and started doing some dry land racing in England. In 2002, her husband had this idea that he wanted to go on a trip to the U.S. and visit all 50 states. And she had known about the Iditarod because of her interest in mushing, and said if they did that, they had to go to Alaska for the Iditarod. So they did, and they were at the start, and they booked one of those tours that flies visitors out to various checkpoints. And at one of those checkpoints, they ran into Tim Osmar, and he said, well, how did you get here? And she said, we got here by airplane. How did you get here? And he said, well, I'm on a dog sled. And even though he was at a checkpoint and in the middle of the race, he answered a lot of her questions, talked to her about mushing, and then went down the trail and finished that year in 15th place. A few years later, when Kim turned 40, her husband said, what do you want to do to celebrate turning 40? And she said she wanted to go back to Iditarod and be an Iditarider. So she was the Iditarider that year for Tim Osmar. And just riding in the basket for those 11 miles, she got totally hooked and decided that she wanted to come back to Alaska and learn how to run dogs. And at the time, the idea of leasing dogs was not nearly as widespread as it is now. So she asked around to try to figure out if there was someone who could take her on and mentor her and lease her a team to run dogs. And she was pointed to Dean Osmar, Tim's father, and he was one of the few people who was leasing teams and really training people at the time. And she said that he put her through the ringer, and that it was like being in boot camp. And she went up and she did that and learned a lot. And then to test herself, she entered the Kinnick 200 in 2007 and finished 14th out of 30. She came back in December 2007, ran the Klondike 300, and at the time, Iditarod only required 500 miles of qualifiers. So she had completed her qualifiers, and she entered the Iditarod in 2008. She was going over an ice bridge in the dark out of Rainy Pass, and she had problems and suddenly noticed that two of her leaders were not there. And what happened is one of her swing dogs had chewed through a line that was connecting the two leaders. So the two leaders got free and ran off, but they were still on a neckline hooked together to each other. And at that point, she made what she later described as a serious rookie mistake. She wasn't sure what to do, so she decided that the best thing to do would be to move forward down the trail to Roan, thinking that the dogs who had done Iditarod before would have gone forward down the trail and she would catch up to them at the checkpoint. And what she realized later is that she should have stayed where she was and camped and waited for the dog to come back to where the team had been. And apparently the dogs had run off somewhere. They came back to where she had been. She wasn't there because she had gone on to Roan. And so they decided that they were going to go back to the last place they had been fed, which was the previous checkpoint at Rainy Pass. And Rainy Pass is not a big hub for Iditarod, and the planes that come in and out there are relatively small planes. And even though there wasn't paperwork for these two dogs, when the two dogs got to Rainy Pass, the people there assumed that they were dogs that had been dropped, so they put them in a small airplane and flew them back to Anchorage. So meanwhile, Kim is in Rhone and doesn't have her dog, so she was withdrawn from the race for not having her dogs and not knowing where the dogs were. They were eventually found and reunited in Anchorage, but her race was over then in 2008. 6 years later, she came back to Alaska. By this point, they had changed the rules for how much you needed, how many miles you needed in qualifiers, plus the qualifiers she had done were back in 2007. So she had to do a new set of qualifiers, started working again with Dean Osmar and his dogs, and she completed the Jinjin 200, the Northern Lights 300, and the Yukon Quest 300 in 2014-2015. And then this year, she ran the Copper Basin, and she was going to run the Knik 200 and Tustamina 200, but they were canceled because of lack of snow. So now she's 8 years older. She has a lot more experience. She specifically, when she was training for this race, did a lot more camping, a lot more going on trails that were slightly unfamiliar so that she could know what to do with her dogs and be prepared if things came up that weren't in her plan. And she said that one of the things that she learned after her 2008 race was that everyone makes mistakes, and it wasn't just her messing up, that everyone messes up at a certain point. And what's important is recognizing that you messed up and being able to go in and change your plan and correct it. So this year, she got to Rhone, which is where she was withdrawn in 2008, and she was able to keep going. And she said that that was a very emotional thing for her. She had 13 dogs in harness at the time, and then she got thrown from her sled, and the dogs kept going. One of the things that we've talked about a lot is when people are learning to mush, one of the first rules that they're taught is no matter what, you hang on. And she, for whatever reason, wasn't able to hang on. The dogs and the sled kept going. And this was just before it was getting dark. They apparently ran for about 10 miles down the trail before they went into the woods and then stopped. Probably the sled overturned. So Kim Franklin got a ride with a snow machiner, but after what happened in 2008, she knew that she couldn't just go to the next checkpoint without her dogs or without any of her dogs. So the next morning, the Iditarod had a helicopter up searching for her team. A lot of snow machiners were out searching for her team. Kim got a ride back to where they had pinpointed by the GPS approximately where the sled was. So she got there, and the dogs were there, and the sled was there, but she noticed that one of her dogs had chewed through his line and gotten free. So, again, here she is on her sled missing a dog, but she was able to find the dog, reattach the dog, and continue on to Nikolai. I can only imagine after what happened in 2008 how completely terrifying it must have been not only to lose dogs but to lose her entire team. But again, she was much better trained and had a better idea of what to do even when her plan had gone drastically off course and was able to think on her feet, figure out what the best thing to do was, go back, find her team, find the dog that had chewed through the line, reattach that dog, and continue. She traveled the last couple hundred miles of her race this year with Kristen Bacon, and she said that that made it much, much more fun. She said before the race that she always knew that she would come back and finish at some point, but it ended up taking her much longer than she thought it would. And one cool thing about her race this year is her main leader was a dog named Animal, who's a 10-year-old dog who ran lead on all of her qualifiers and also was a dog that she ran as a yearling on her 2018. She also had another dog named Mekong, who completed the Iditarod last year with Cindy Abbott. And when she came into McGrath this year, she was greeted by a couple with a British flag who apparently were on their honeymoon and had flown up the trail to root her on because she's British as well. We are really, really thrilled that she was able to complete her Iditarod, which, given what happened to her in 2008 and what happened to her earlier in this race, was just an amazing accomplishment and just a wonderful thing to see.
Awesome stuff. So there you have it, our 16 nightly musher profiles. We've had a lot of them. And, you know, I mentioned this just the other day. We have a fan out there that listens to our shows while she's woodworking in her woodworking shop. And she says that she absolutely loves our mushing profile segments throughout Iditarod. And she has listened to the DD Genre episode 70 to 100 times. Now, that is a super fan if I've ever heard one, Alex. And, you know, I have to commend her to listening to our voices that many times. But, you know, I guess people yeah. find solace in one way or the other. Some people listen to talk radio. Other people listen to jazz or classical. And some of them listen to you and I, Alex. So that's pretty interesting in of itself, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, I want to take this opportunity to thank you. Robert, because when you asked me to start hosting these shows with you a few years back, I thought, oh, that'll be fun. But I have had such a great time doing these. I've had an amazing time interacting with our listeners and fans, and have, in the course of this and in the course of reading about the people on the trail and talking to mushers and talking to fans and talking to reporters, have just learned an enormous amount. And so I'm very thankful to you, and I'm very happy that we've been able to do this.
Oh, I am too, Alex, because you have no idea how difficult it is just to sit here in front of a microphone and talk to yourself. And, you know, thousands of people are listening to you, and you have no idea if you're communicating correctly or not. So I do have to give you a round of thanks too. It is so much easier to have you along. You're an excellent researcher for all of our stories, and you keep up to date with this, and you're a great wingman, I guess, if I could call you that, for one. So before we thank our fans, and I know you have a couple you want to talk about, your Twitter buddies and folks that stay up all night with you on Twitter and talk about Iditarod, but we've done this for the last couple of years. Just a real quick couple of minutes, maybe. What has been your favorite story of Iditarod this year? And then I'll give you mine as well.
You know, I think realizing this afternoon that Kim Franklin had basically lost dogs both in 2008 and this year, and then was able to finish. I think that possibly is my favorite story from this year.
Awesome stuff. You know, my favorite story just happened to be one that we talked about last night, and it was Trent Herbst giving the little diplomas to his rookie dog.
Right.
And, you know, being a musher out there and seeing these little guys just become sled dogs. You know, it happens on training runs. It happens on races. They literally grow up in front of your eyes in just a few minutes. They become, you know, the squirrely, unsure. Think about a teenager, you know, real awkward, not sure what they're supposed to do. They're constantly getting tangled. And then all of a sudden they truly grow up in front of your eyes. And, you know, when you talked about that story last night, I saw all of my dogs that have been on that same sort of path. And, you know, it was so happy and bittersweet when my daughter graduated high school last year. I'm not one that usually cries much, Alex, but I was crying at my daughter's graduation because I knew it, and I didn't do it for my son, but I knew she was, she became a young lady at that point. And I think that Trent sort of had the same idea of when he gave his little diplomas to those little dogs, they became sled dogs. And I thought that was such a touching story. I don't know if a lot of folks caught that story, you know, when it was on Iditarod.com or the nightly news. But as a musher, I think that by far that is my favorite story of Iditarod.
Yeah, and every year we have a half dozen or a dozen stories like that. And it's for me, these little stories, you know, a few years back there was, for some reason, the Millennium had pulled out of the First to the Yukon Award. So they were not going to give a cash award to the first team to the Yukon. And Scott Jensen, the mushing mortician, stepped up and he said that he would put up the cash to give that award. And then at the banquet, he gave the cash award out in a little miniature coffin because he's a mortician. And it's those sort of little silly things that just I find endlessly endearing. I love those details, and I love how there are so many great traditions that come up around Iditarod. Martin, there's an article today, Martin Boozer said that he's reevaluating how he's going to approach Iditarod in the future and is going to see it more as a chance to go out and visit the villages. And I think that there's a lot of great human interest stories that we don't get to hear nearly enough that go on the trail about how the mushers interact with the people along the trail. And I know we've tried every year to bring more of those stories to people and to highlight the things that you just don't get to hear about all that much.
Totally agree there. So, Alex, who do you want to give a shout-out to? What fans out there in particular? I know your Twitter buddies. Who do you want to say hello to?
Oh, I want to say hello to Karen and Tony and Quince Mountain. And I want to thank one more time June Price, who wrote Backstage Iditarod, which is a book that really got me excited about Iditarod. Helen Hegener, who from Northern Lights Media, who is unbelievably active in terms of posting lots of great stories on Facebook and was one of the people who was most active in organizing and helping people with in the aftermath of the Sockeye fire. I want to thank all of the people who contributed to the book Iditarod the first 10 years, which is just a remarkable, wonderful book that everyone should buy. I want to particularly thank all of the fans and all of the mushers who have for a long time who have been really willing and open to talk to me about what this thing is that they do and why they do it. And I am so thankful that people are trusting me and trusting us to tell their stories. And it's something that I think is really important and something I take fairly seriously.
Good stuff, Alex, for sure. You know, a lot of those same folks I wanted to thank as well, but I definitely have to give out a shout out to all of our fans this year in particular. Man, we've had so many questions and comments. We've had an absolutely fabulous year in terms of folks listening. You know, we were a relatively small podcast for a long time, and when you have 9,000 plus live listeners on a night, you have to thank all those folks. They stuck out, they stuck it out and listened to us and downloaded our episodes and told their friends and families and all that. So we want to make sure that we thank all those guys and, you know, all those folks that that make this possible as well. And with that, Alex, again, putting you on the spot a little bit, are we going to continue our biweekly show coming up in a couple of weeks? Are you up for that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Very good.
Absolutely.
So we air
I'm not quite sure what we're going to talk about. At the moment, I feel like I'm a little bit overwhelmed with Iditarod 2016, but I'm sure we'll find some stuff to talk about.
We will. We air those on Wednesday nights at 5 o'clock Alaska time over on KVRF 89.5 here in the Mat-Su Valley. And then they're available on our website on dogworksradio.com and iTunes and social media thereafter. And, of course, if you guys ever have topics, questions, concerns, whatever, you can always send us a line, and we will try to cover them as well. So we will be on the air in 2 weeks on Wednesday. So we look forward to talking to you as well. Alex, anything you want to say in closing, finishing out the 2016 Iditarod coverage?
I just want to mention that every year we talk about some of the returning racers and people who are up and coming. It is feeling to me like we're really on the cusp in the next couple of years of a big generational turnover in Iditarod, and I would not be surprised to see some of the sort of older guard start to still be there, but to really fade as some of the younger racers like Wade Mars and Yor Olsom are becoming more and more dominant. So I think that we are definitely going to see that. I was told this afternoon that this is the 21st anniversary of Libby Riddles winning the Iditarod, the first time a woman won the Iditarod. And I, like a lot of people, I really would like to see a woman win the race again. So whether that's Allie Zirkel or, you know, Jody Bailey or someone else, I think that I'm hopeful that that's going to happen in the next few years as well.
Very good. So on behalf of my co-host who stuck it out with me for yet another year, Alex Stein, he is the writer and director of Mush, the movie. You can find him on Facebook. I believe he has a website as well. We'll make sure we put a link on that too. Thank you very much for joining us over the last couple of weeks, Alex, as well as all of our fans. Thank you again to KVRF here in the Valley for hosting us every night on our typically weekly show. They've really gone out of their way to make sure that we were on there every night. So I want to thank them as well. Alex, take care. We'll talk in a couple of weeks, okay?
Sounds good. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, and myself, thanks for listening to our 2016 Iditarod coverage. We'll see you guys next March. Goodbye.